They all kind of run together. Because I've seen one place it listed as Heavy in the Hand, and the another place they're listed as three track called Heavy in the Hand. Anyways, that was Audrey Chen. Before that, Abel Magard with Upon the Smallest Circulation from Above the Dreams on Ecstatic Peace. That's a 2LP. KTL before that with Mad Hit, and that's from The Pyre. Versions Distilled to Stereo on the Shelter Press. Katerina Barbieri before that with How to Decode an Illusion. That's from Born Again in the Voltage on Important Records. And Lionel Marchetti and Cat Hope started that off with Premiere Etude, Les Ombres. And that's from The Last Days of Reality. And poetry is up next. This has been A Different Nature. You can podcast the show, and also the playlist will be posted to the website shortly if it's not there already. Thank you for listening. And this is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to Wider Window Poetry. This is a new poetry show. I'm your host. My name is Teal Ansari, and I'm thrilled to be here, and I'm so happy to have been invited to host this show by KBOO. And Wider Window Poetry is going to bring you voices you may not have heard from places you may not have been. And today, I'm going to begin. I do have a live guest who will come on in a few minutes, but I'm going to begin by reading a couple of poems by a poet named Yunus Emre, who is a Sufi poet, lived in Anatolia in what's now Turkey, and died about 1320. We don't know exactly when he was born. And we're fortunate to have some of his work now in translation. I'm going to read from a book titled The Drop That Became the Sea, which was translated by Kabir Helminski and Rafik Algan from Shambhala Publications. So this is Yunus Emre. I have found the soul of souls. Let this soul of mine be taken. I have forgotten gain and loss. Let this shop of mine be plundered. I have passed beyond my very self. I've removed the veils before me. I cut all ties and went to the friend. I fell in with God. Let my poems be scattered. I drank the wine of suffering. Let all my remedies be thrown out. I have passed up dreams. I have tired of summers and winters. I have found the gardener of flowers. Let this garden of mine be dug up. I have found the honey of honeys. Let this hive of mine be given away. And then another poem by Yunus Emre. We entered the house of realization. We witnessed the body, the whirling skies, the many-layered earth, the 70,000 veils we found in the body, the night and the day, the planets, the words inscribed on the holy tablets, the hill that Moses climbed, the temple, and Israfel's trumpet we observed in the body. Torah, Psalms, Gospel, Quran, what these books have to say, we found in the body. Everybody says these words of Yunus are true. Truth is wherever you want it. We found it all within the body. Yunus Emre, The Drop That Became the Sea, Shambhala Publications. And now I'd like to introduce today's guest, Emmett Wheatfall. Emmett lives in Portland, Oregon, where he reads, writes, publishes, and performs poetry. And he has published 6 books, including He Sees Things, 2010, We Think We Know, 2011, The Meaning of Me, 2012, Bread Widow, 2013, Fragments, 2015, and most recently, As Clean as a Bone, 2018, which you will hear bits of today. Emmett served on the nomination committees for the selection of our most recent 3 Oregon Poets Laureate, Peter Sears, Elizabeth Woody, and Kim Stafford. He was a featured poet at the 50th anniversary celebration of the March on Washington in the Portland event. He's been a keynote speaker for the Oregon Historical Society's Oregon Black History Series program in 2013. And in 2017, he gave the keynote address for the Oregon Poetry Association's annual conference. And the title of his keynote address was Can Poets Change the World? And as an attendee at that conference, I can tell you that the answer was yes. And not only did he convince us all that poets can change the world, but that poets should. And those words of his continued to resonate throughout the rest of the conference. In addition to his books, Emmett has recorded CDs of poetry, one spoken word CD titled I Speak, and four CDs of spoken word with music. When I Was Young, 2010, I Loved You Once, 2011, Them Poetry Blues, 2013, and Welcome Home, 2017. Again, we'll hear selections from some of those, and these albums feature some of Oregon's most gifted jazz, blues, and pop musicians and artists. Emmett has performed lyrical spoken word poetry in local jazz venues such as, well, everything really, Ivory's Jazz Lounge and Restaurant, Tony Starlight's, the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall, and Jimmy Mack's Eminent Jazz Club. And you can find out more about Emmett on his website, emmettwheatfall.com. And I will now shut up and let you listen to Emmett.
This woman who knows me not, of Peruvian origin by way of the plantation, where the sun is ornamental and the heat distilling, where bananas are golden, and this woman, beautiful, this woman of Peru, I love her. A humble woman with olive-colored skin, soft like sheep's wool tendered from lamb, a body shaped by toil traced in time, eyes the innocence of tomorrow, with hope only for today. This woman of Peru, whose hands are as firm as the banana leaf, her heart sweeter than the sweetest sunset, a smile brighter than the brightest day, her tears reminiscent of tender tulips. This woman of Peru, I love her. When the rain falls, she laughs. She finds time to dance, to twirl in the hot shower. The brown clay softens her feet. I look and to myself laugh. My heart beats the more for her. She is me and I am her. She doesn't know it. This woman of Peru, who knows me not, I love her.
Teal, it's great to be with you. Thank you for the opportunity to come in and talk poetry. I know it's an art form that you and I both love. And that was a Peruvian off one of my earlier CDs called I Loved You Once. And the pianist on that piece is the great Ramsey Embick. He lives here in Portland, at least the last that I knew. Lived here in Portland. I think he was band leader for a number of great secular professional groups and stuff like that, and we went in the studio, and he put some wonderful piano music to the lyrics of Peruvian. It's a great piece.
And so was that fairly impromptu then, or had he spent some time with the poem and sort of done a formal composing process?
You know, it's interesting because the lyric, because even though it was a poem first, but then getting together with Ramsey Embick, he put the piano composition to it. And I think we recorded that in probably about two takes. He started playing, I started reciting, and what came out of that I think was pretty magical. And that's what happens when you get really great talent like that. Mm-hmm. I think he was a band leader for the Pointer Sisters. He had played and interact with Michael Jackson, so he's top notch, clearly a talented professional. So it was pretty easy to marry the poem, the lyrics, with the music.
So I really want to explore with you in particular the relationship between words and music and mm-hmm. between poetry and music. And I'm going to read you this quote, try not to explode, but it's, and I'm not going to embarrass the source by naming him, but he says, lyrics are not poetry. They are the words to a song.
I don't agree with that whatsoever. I mean, you know, I always try to tell people that lyrical poetry or words that that are fit to a meter goes back as far as the origins of poetry, to Socrates and Plato, to the troubadours and bards of many cultures. And, you know, what's fascinating about poetry when they're particular as lyrics is because there's a meter. You know, music has a 4-4 time, 3-4 time. Well, most people don't understand that poetry, there's a thing called metrical poetry. As a matter of fact, I tell people that those who know poetry know that oftentimes Shakespeare wrote an iambic pentameter. And you can actually take maybe the soliloquy from Othello, her father loved me once, often invited me, still questioned me the story of my life from year to year. I ran it through from my boyish days to the very moment he bit. You can actually take that and put that in time to music and it would fit. So to say that words that syntactically are put in with music is not lyric, it's just not correct, in my opinion.
And I think we suffer some from dealing with poetry and translation often. For instance, Greek poetry or classical Chinese poetry, in order to capture the meaning, you necessarily lose a lot of the structure and a lot of the rhyme, the meter, whatever equivalents of those are in the original language. So let's listen to another CD and then go a little further with this.
Sounds good to me. Linger near Alfie. Baby blue hummingbirds fly by Alfie. Crooked chalk lines, Alfie. Ought to put that scotch down, Alfie. I'm too old to hopscotch, Alfie. Our flag is beyond half staff, Alfie. Serendipity is setting in, Alfie. I still love you, Alfie. Old souls linger near, Alfie. Baby blue hummingbirds fly by, Alfie. Crooked chalk lines, Alfie. Ought to put down that scotch, Alfie. I'm too old to hopscotch, Alfie. Our flag is beyond half staff, Alfie. Serendipity is setting in, Alfie. I still love you, Alfie. I still love you. I just love Alfie. That's Nathan Olson, the great pianist out of Salem, Oregon, the legendary Nathan Olson. If you remember, you hear the chords when you're at the end as they walk down the chords. I just gave him those like 6-7 chords, and he just actually just put the body of the rest of the music up under those lyrics. And Nathan's great pianist, and I love working with him.
You know, listening to that end portion put me in mind of, I forget which famous classical violinist said, well, anyone can play the notes like I do, but it's the spaces between the notes.
Oh, absolutely. It's the silence between the notes. Yes, love that.
I think that applies really well to poetry as well. You can read a line in just kind of an even rhythm, but if you pay attention to the cadence, I think it can strengthen the poetry a lot. Is that your experience as well?
Well, you know, I understand that there are some academics in poetry who say you should just read it in your normal voice and the normal pace and let the words themselves speak. But that would be like going to a college class where you have a 3-credit-hour class and you have a monotone teacher that just speaks. It's going to be tough in the evening trying to stay up. No, words, like, you know, I often think about the word beautiful, but if you said beautiful, if you add inflection stuff to it like that, it gives a tone, a sonic to it, a resonance to it. And I think when you're reading poetry, you want to be true to the text, the syntax, the diction, but there's nothing wrong with giving a poem flavor, in my opinion.
I guess there's an argument for that in the modern age, when you write a poem, you know that probably more people are going to read it, interact with it visually, than are going to hear it spoken or read. And so should you play to that? Should you try and have the poem stand mostly on its meaning? Or should you try and stand on the more performative elements, the sound and the rhythm? Mm.
I saw on television once a guy who was a keynote speaker at a conference, and he asked the guy to stand, a guy out of the audience, he says, can you sing? And everybody said, yeah, at every point that guy could sing. So they asked him it wasn't a church-related thing, but he says, ask him, sing a song. And he said, sing Amazing Grace. And the guy just sang Amazing Grace. And everybody applauded, it was beautiful. Then he asked him, sing it as if your mother had died. And the way he sang it, with that in mind, the context for which he was singing, almost brought tears to people's eyes. So I want to make the argument that it's the context. It's, to me, it's how the voice or the message, the theme of the poem, speaks to a person. And one other thing I'm passionate about, I try to tell people all the time, poetry was always spoken out loud. The troubadours and bards would have stringed instruments, and they'd go from geographic territory to territory, and they would sing or they would say the verse, but they would do it accompanying the music until the printing press came. And then when stuff started to go down in terms of literature and chap books and stuff, people started reading poetry in their head and not out loud. I've never been kicked out of Borders, but I should have been, because if I pick up a poetry book in Borders or Barnes & Noble, and I'm telling you, it speaks, I'm reading that out loud right there in the bookstore, because that's the way poetry should be done. It should be read out loud.
So with that in mind, would you read to us some from your recent work, which you have there, mm-hmm. As Clean as a Bone?
Oh, I'd be delighted to do that. And As Clean as a Bone is my sixth book. And some say I'm a prolific writer. I love doing it. But a little bit about the book. Now, the title is Clean as a Bone. Most folks are familiar with James Baldwin, the late great black intellectual. And he was noted for that great, great poetry he writes, playwright stuff. But he debated William F. Buckley, a conservative. And it was one of the great, great intellectual debates between a sort of progressive and conservative. And I was reading an article one day. And I tell two people all the time, if you're going to be a writer or a poet or whatever, you have to read. Your well is not deep enough. I don't have enough knowledge of life to be able to draw from that well all the time. And in the article, it is ascribed to James Baldwin. He said, when you write a sentence, write it as clean as a bone. And that jumped off. It just jumped off and wrapped me like a blanket on a cold day. And so I titled the book, As Clean as a Bone. And this is the first poem in the book. It's titled As Clean as a Bone. And here's an epigraph. It's a little statement before the poem begins. And the epigraph reads, you want to write a sentence as clean as a bone. That is the goal. James Baldwin. Here's the poem. I have never seen a bone of mine. I have written a sentence, though. More than one sentence, to be exact. At least two sentences I have written. For the epigraph above, I cleaned them. Any combination of two sentences, I have given myself to clean them, stripping them of flesh and sinew, displacing great regard for each bone, where be it for presence of soul, for the epigraph, I clean them, as that is the goal, Mr. Baldwin. As clean as a bone. He was just absolutely, absolutely brilliant. May I share another?
Yes, please.
All right. I want to put a little plug in for a poet out of Seattle, Washington. And his name is Robert Lashley. Robert Lashley. And in my opinion, he is probably the Walt Whitman of poetry in the Northwest. He is absolutely brilliant. And if you ever get an opportunity to interview Robert Lashley, I would really encourage you. But he has been such an inspiration to me. When I've encountered him and we've been in the kind of the same place, one time I saw him, he had this thick book under his arm, and it was A.H. Auden. He was carrying around a thick book of his work. So I wrote this poem titled, A Little Black Boy Pauses to Listen. I walk nowhere, with baritone voice offend. Naked trees shiver. A little white girl pauses to listen. Crumpled leaves scatter. On the park bench is Leaves of Grass by Walt Whitman. Negro ballers keep hooping. Bassinets sit unfurled. Lovers bask in memories past. Dope fiends fiend. I walk nowhere. With baritone voice read aloud The Homeboy Songs by Robert Lashley. A little black boy pauses to listen. Naked trees shiver. From As Clean as a Bone. You know, we live in a society where, you know, I don't rail against law enforcement. You know, the bulk of law enforcement are people who get up every day, go do their job. They're trying to protect our communities so we can have a civil society. We all know that there are some people in law enforcement who just don't, they don't wear the 10-gallon hat. And this is a poem I wrote called Poor Boy. Not poor in wealth, but poor in spirit. Poor boy felt he had nowhere to turn. When facing a wall higher than I, he thought, conceit. Poor boy leaned forward as if it were a wailing wall, spreading all 10 fingers as wide as possible. He prepared expressly for the beatdown in lieu of the policy that required a pat-down. I whispered to him that if we awake, inhale as deep as you can, then hold it. For every breath, poor boy, is all you will ever own, it being what little breath is left in your broken body. Poor boy. Are you open to some more? You let me know.
So I would like to ask you another question, actually.
Sure.
Which is about, obviously, you engage race in your writing, and you appear to engage it pretty freely. Is there some reluctance? Do you feel there's some risk to doing that?
Yeah, there is risk. Let me say it this way. There is risk. I think one of the things that's challenging, I love spoken word as much as anyone else, and I love page poetry. But sometimes with spoken word, and especially with some of the younger poets, I get a little concerned when I hear poets, for example, talking about revolution. I wonder, and sometimes you'll hear them passionately give brilliant poems, tears coming out of their eyes, talking about the need for revolution. But I want to ask, have you ever been shot? Have you ever been stabbed with a bayonet? You know, when we look at how people are suffering from PTSD coming back from war zones, I think that if you're going to do sometimes political poetry, social justice poetry, what I try to apply to myself is make sure that I do my homework, that I know what I'm talking about. If I'm going to write about something that involves LGBTQ issues, I need to make sure that I actually do the research so that when the content of what I'm talking about, that the terminology that I use, the diction that I use is correct. And I do believe that there's a place for social justice political poetry because, and I'll characterize it to you this way. In the day that we're living in, we have really lost a lot of confidence in our religious leaders. I think many of our major religious leaders today have failed us. Religious institutions have not really lived out what they purported to espouse politically. Oh, you know, we just, the stuff that we go through. So I have a little phrase that I say. I believe that poets are the secular prophets of our day. And if you look at in history, in any Pablo Neruda, you can just look at the poets who, in times of national, international crisis, it's really the poets at the end of the day that have spoken in a voice and in a language that people are willing to hear. So I'm not afraid to do political poetry, but I want to make sure that I know what I'm talking about. I do it in a way that endears people to hear and not to incite violence or division. And that's what As Clean as a Bone does. It's not throwing rocks through windows. It's designed to do point and contrast, I call it. I want a white person to be able to sit in their living room or their parlor and be able to put on the lens of As Clean as a Bone and see blackness through the poetry, not to throw rocks and break windows.
And you've also brought some of your more recent work, it looks like, that follows along that vein.
I do.
And would you share some of that?
Oh, I would love to. As a matter of fact, these are more social justice kinds of poems. And what I did, because of time, I tried to bring some stuff that was short. So I got about three or four poems that are kind of short. This is called America's Noble Ideal. A madman has arisen with a mad face, using mean words that rally racists in a nation bewildered by wantonness, from wanton men and wanton women who weary the huddled masses in the midst of America's noble ideal. It's called America's Noble Ideal. Let me share with you Constitution. I really like this. Pay close attention to what's being communicated. It's called Constitution. I'm written because I will not hurt anyone, and neither should you. What do you mean, said the pen to paper? How far is fantasy from reality? The truth I hold is self-evident. What truth, replied the pen? We the people. Let us challenge the living and loud reverence for the dead. By you and on me is penned America's liberty. Just a couple more. This will probably resonate with the immigration issue. Sanctuary city. Go back to Mexico, shouts an elderly woman. This impertinent white woman felt emboldened, much the way a Chinese seamstress embroiders a pattern made during a moment of inspiration. Astonished is the Latin American cashier, Diego. Is not from Mexico. Diego's from Maryland, having immigrated to the United States with his father, mother, two siblings, two uncles, and an aunt. Isles is where the chili pepper is kept. A tall and stout Texan is offering sushi samples. The Texan asks the elderly woman, would you like to try one? She says, why, yes, then smiles. And then this is called America is Our Home. America is our home. My arrival to this land was by land, among a caravan of immigrants who knew not the sea, who seized not upon the smell of salty sea, we women, children, we men. I'm taught pilgrims came by way of sea, crowding hull of seafaring vessels carved from trees. They wanted to spill dirt from their hands while kneeling on bended knee. Is there something to be said for before and after? Wisdom knows not who's coming or going. Are the first truly last and the last truly first? All that's ever in the middle should be shared. Go back to your country. Nah. That land is too far and away, and the sea too choppy to breach. America is our home. America is our home. A little bit about the immigration issue.
So I think we'd like to hear a couple more from the CDs now, and then I'll have some sort of boring, typical questions to ask you.
Sounds good. I've been to Mississippi, not the Mississippi that precedes me, nor the great state of Mississippi, but North Mississippi.
The Mississippi that crosses North Skidmore and Fremont streets. That Mississippi. There I met this mixed girl. More than once I met this mixed girl who liked black boys. Me? I was as black can be. That's why she really, really liked me. When we hung out on North Mississippi in the inner city. Mixed girl had a white mama. She too really, really liked me. Her daddy was black like me. He too was as black can be. On North Mississippi, where I hung out with mixed girl, between North Skidmore and Fremont streets. Her mama thought of me dearly. Her daddy, the epitome of insincere, because her mama used to like black boys too. Black boys that look like me. Where mixed girl and I hung out, because I was as black can be, on North Mississippi. Mixed girl could really shake her back. Me and mixed girl had no shame. Me and mixed girl played the game. Until one day, her daddy called me out my name. Because I was as black can be. Even though he too was as black as me. When mixed girl hung out with me. And that brought an end to everything. Because mixed girl's daddy, who too was black can be, didn't want her liking a black boy like me, who was as black can be, when mixed girl and I hung out on North Mississippi. So I tell everybody, I've been to Mississippi. Licking chicken. I know they slim picking, but still, I'm gonna fry me some chicken. Now that's what I'm gonna do, just like Big Mama Sue. That's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna eat me some watermelon. I'm gonna eat me some sweet watermelon. Boy, I'm gonna have me some fun, 'cause I'm gonna eat me some watermelon. Now that's what I'm gonna do, just like Big Mama Sue. That's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna drink me some liquor. I'm gonna drink me some good old corn liquor. Now don't y'all start to whisper, 'cause I'm gonna drink me some liquor. Now that's what I'm gonna do, just like Granddaddy Lou. That's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna buy me a pie. I'm gonna buy me a sweet potato pie. Man, I ain't gonna lie. Why? I'm gonna buy me a pie. Now that's what I'm gonna do. Just like Granddaddy Lou, I'm gonna buy me a pie. On a sad day, we tell our stories of risk and surprise, of life and loss, of having won even in the midst of defeat. On a sad day, this is what we do. We war with each other, with ourselves, with the internal conflicts found in conscience, with the enmity in relationships, all on a sad day. Still, we find time to sing the old song, the new song, to pray, to recite endearing terms of love, of longing, those songs of passion on a sad day. My, 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 my. That's what we do on a sad day. Make sure you understand where the poet's coming from. Listen. On a sad day, we tell our stories of risk and surprise, of life and loss, of having won even in the midst of defeat. Oh, we do this on a sad day. When we got the blues, when we got the blues. We war with each other, with ourselves, with the internal conflicts found in conscience, with the enmity in relationships, all of this on a sad day when we got the blues. Still, we find time to sing the old song, a new song, to pray, to recite endearing terms of love, of longing, those songs of passion on a sad day when we got the blues. I know when I had the blues, I sang this sad song on a sad day when we tell our stories of risk and surprise, of life and loss, of having won even in the middle of defeat.
journey through the mind of Emmett Wheatfall.
So can you speak a little bit about those three we just heard?
Mm-hmm.
Just whatever seems interesting.
Well, you know, it was from the album entitled Them Poetry Blues, and my producer, the record label is Peterson Entertainment. Producer was Noah Peterson, and went in the studio over 2 days and brought together some really talented musicians, Nathan Olson out of Salem, Lewis Payne, the B3 Hammond, just a bunch of other folks. Matter of fact, Janice Scroggins, the late great Janice Scroggins, is on that album as well. And what I did was I just took poetry and we just put it to music, and a lot of the musical composition was done right there in the studio. I tell people all the time, if you listen to what people have heard, is it's not like you get verse A, verse B, bridge, and then you get verse C, verse D, and then you get this hook that you repeat over and over and over. When you're doing lyrical poetry, you're actually telling a story, and you've got to go from A to Z, and you've got to keep all of that in time. And you're not like a saxophone where you could hold a note. You know, you can do a half note, you could do a three-quarter note or whatever. So you really, you're a bird on a wire. And I think it takes a little bit of ability to be able to do that and do it in such a way that it resonates with those people. But I think the first cut that was played was Mississippi Mixed Girl. And in Portland, there's North Mississippi in North Portland. And I just did made it metaphorical between the great state of Mississippi and North Mississippi in Portland. And I was playing off the fact that the young man is of a dark hue, African, black. And the biracial girl's father is black as well, but he doesn't want the black kid who looks like him to talk to his daughter. So that deals with a little bit of the racial connotations. And then from there, we went with one that was really kind of silly. It was really funny, you know, about pie and about chicken and stuff like that. But if you notice in that one, for those folks who like poetry, you hear a lot of vowels, like Y, I. Those things are really rudiments to play with in poetry. And then the last cut on Them Poetry Blues is called On a Sad Day. And I love that. That is just straight up pure jazz, spoken word. And it just tells the story of a sad day. So this is the kind of stuff I think about. It's the kind of stuff that comes out of my creative imagination. I ride down the freeway. If I'm going to Salem somewhere or Seattle, I just pop the top, get in the right lane, and just put on this music and just leave the planet. I've got my eye on the road, but I'm but I leave the planet. Yeah, so anyway, a little background on those.
All right, so we have some of the standard kind of poetry process type questions. Mm. What brought you to poetry?
I was actually brought to it. A colleague I work with wrote a poem for her husband's 60th birthday. And she likes my voice, so she said, "Would you read it?" And when I read the poem, it wasn't very well written. And it was hard to read because it wasn't very well written. So what I said to her, "Would you permit me to actually clean this up? I will read yours first, telling you, but then I'll read my cleanup version." So, but I wanted to do more. And so I thought, and I'd never done it before. So I called up Janice Scroggins and I said, "Would you be willing to play while I recite her poem?" And we went into a studio and we recorded it and I played it for her husband. She said he played it for 2 weeks, every day for 2 weeks, because he really loved it. But I was bit, and I started to study poetry, not just write on a page and make it look like, you know, a poem. I wanted to make sure that if I'm being interviewed by you, that I could talk the language of poetry. What is a macron? What is a brev? What is a caissera? You know, what is, you know, just the rudiments. Music has all of its rudiments of it. I wanted to make sure I could do that. I was listening to Will Smith's son on a radio one day, and he was telling people he really loved poetry and liked writing poetry. And the interview guy says, "Well, whose poetry do you like?" He said, "Well, I like Shakespeare's." And he says, "Of Shakespeare's poetry, what do you like?" And you heard crickets. And I just never, so I wanted to study the craft of poetry.
And how long ago was this?
About a decade ago, about 10 years ago. I did theater in high school and college, but then when you get married and have to get a job and you have raising kids, there's only so much room for stuff. So I'm so glad that poetry came and apprehended me.
Mm. Yeah, and so you work full-time for the city of Milwaukee?
I work for Clackamas County.
I'm an assistant county administrator,
yeah.
And so how do you find time to write? Do you have a routine, a daily writing practice, or is it sort of catch as catch can?
You know, it's I'm very fortunate because we work four-day work weeks, 7 to 6, and those are pretty full days. But I have Friday off, and so it has afforded me the luxury of being able to have a full day off. And usually I'll spend a lot of time at coffee shop, Fridays, Saturdays, sometimes Sundays after church. And then I'll write sometimes in the evening. But there's no real set time. And there's another thing I discovered, too, is that sometimes it's just nothing comes. It just nothing. And Pauline Peterson, one of the poet laureates, just a great ambassador, she told a story of William Stafford, Oregon's greatest poet laureate, said a young student in high school asked him, says, "What do you do when nothing comes?" And he says, I'm not sure what you mean. And he gets, "Well, what do you do when you're staring at a blank page and you don't have nothing to write?" He said, "I've never experienced that." He said, I just write. And it frightened me when I first started, when nothing would come. I got frightened. And what I learned was I need to let the field rest. When nothing comes, it's all right. Let that break occur. And I tell you, when it comes back, I don't know where it comes from, maybe from the poetry gods, Mount Olympus for poetry, but it just comes like a rushing river. So, but I write all the time. I have a voluminous amount of poetry, so...
When you have a poem, and I phrase it this way because I've told people it's sort of halfway between having the flu and having a child. Mm. What is usually the first thing that comes to you? Is it a phrase, an image, maybe a feeling?
It's a phrase. On Them Poetry Blues, it's about 8 minutes. Miss Janice Scroggins and her 88 Keys. And as you know, Janice Scroggins was otherworldly gifted. She was Grammy nominated. She played ragtime type music. She could play one rhythm in one hand and simultaneously. One day I was sitting on my sofa and the phrase, most grand pianos, 88 keys. I sat down on the sofa and this phrase, 88 keys. And for probably about the next 8 hours, probably from about 4 in the afternoon till about 2 in the morning, I'm writing. And then several hours over the next few days until it was done. So it was that phrase. But, Teal, the thing I love about poetry is that I feel like I'm a safe cracker. I mean, I turn the tumble, click, and then it's click and click. And then when I could turn the handle and it would open... I've got poems that I've written years ago that I wouldn't change a comma, I wouldn't change a semicolon, I wouldn't change a word. That poem is like that safe that's been cracked and it's open. I wouldn't change a thing. It's there it is. And so usually with me, it's probably a phrase because I'm really an orator kind of that way. So. Yeah.
So I think we have one more piece of music.
Yeah. Let me set that one up. That's from the my latest album called Welcome Home. And the pianist is Jim Blackburn, a phenomenal Portland pianist. And I wrote a poem called Brown People Were Here. And the poem was written before the music. And so we got together. He wrote the music. And this is really amazing. I'm actually putting this poem into that music in time to make it work. Brown people were here. Mm-hmm. Bring them pigeons, brown people were here. Feed them Big Mama's cornbread while you sip lemonade from a mason's jar. Lemonade tastes better from a mason's jar. Do it shoeless, seated on the south side. Let your feet swing back and forth. Trust me, it's nostalgic. Trust me, them there pigeons will remember brown people were here. Mr. and Mrs. Arthur B. Blackwell III strolled here. Exchanged vows under that oak tree over there. Were baptized by Reverend A.C. Franklin II in the pond right there. Never before were so many brown people known to gather here. But now, brown people don't eat cornbread and drink lemonade from a mason's jar. Their feet don't swing back and forth here. And Big Mama, she's been long dead this year. Them pigeons right there, they'll remember brown people were here.
Emmett, when I first met you, you were recovering from throat surgery. Mm-hmm. And as I understood it, there was actually a possibility you could have lost your voice at that mm-hmm. time, which I think we all agree would have been a terrible tragedy. Mm-hmm. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think when you do as much vocal stuff as I do, I'm a conference speaker, a trainer, just a lot of stuff. If you don't use your voice properly, I got a note on one of my vocal cords, and so I had to go into surgery and have it removed. And there's always a danger when they remove a node from a vocal cord that your vocals could be damaged. And I was very fortunate, very blessed that the surgeon that did the removal did an excellent job, and no damage. But then also too, the physical therapist told me that I said, "Emmett, you're a vocal athlete." And you're not using it. Are you warming up your voice? So when you're doing these lyrical performances and these readings, you're really, and he gave me techniques on how to warm up my voice. So I have to move from just being someone who uses my voice to someone who uses my voice professionally and correctly. Yeah.
And could you tell me, what is the one place in the world you would most like to visit and why?
I'd love to go back to Polynesia. Hawaii, I don't care. I love the evenings, the palm trees. It's so, so me, Polynesia.
All right, thank you very much. That was Emmett Wheatfall, who's been our guest for this past hour. And this is Wider Window Poetry, bringing you voices you may not have heard from places you may not have been. I'm your host, Teal Ansari. Thank you all for listening.
And we walked back to the road, unchanged.
KBOO Community Radio is the proud co-sponsor of the third annual David Bowie Memorial Bike Ride on his birthday, Tuesday, January 8th. Come ride your bike around Portland with Diablos. We celebrate the life and music of David Bowie with a mobile dance party and sing-along. Again, that's the third annual David Bowie Memorial Bike Ride at 8 p.m. on January 8th at the corner of Southwest Broadway and Main in downtown Portland near the Schnitzer. More information can be found on the KBOO website under Community Events.
Attention, KBOO supporters. We apologize for the nonsensical on-air acknowledgments that have aired after recent membership drives. We assure you that those responsible have been dealt with appropriately, and the spot they conceived for this promo will never air. Please enjoy this message instead.
On behalf of the entire KBOO community, we'd like to offer our deepest and sincerest thanks for your contribution to KBOO's Give Guide campaign. Your support makes KBOO possible. Thank you!
Ah, free of complexity, controversy, and most importantly, hawk screeches.
Support KBOO, where music makes the movement.
This is KBOO Portland.
This is Carolina, or Carol, but Carolina works, and this is I See You.
Stories of an immigrant making home on a gentrifying block. I can't even tell. This looks like a six and seven.
And yes, I am aware that I barely have an accent. But immigrants don't have to have one. Chapter 3, Soul of a Place.
I didn't move around, you know. Like I said, my mother passed 10 years ago and, you know, she was living in that same house. And like I said, even though I went to the, got bussed out, I went to the same school, to the same elementary school. You know, I never transferred high school, which brought me to really be such a communal person, you know, because I haven't moved around a lot, you know. But I'm very welcoming to those that want to be welcomed. Because I have seen a lot of people around here that seem like they don't want to meet and talk. So I don't, you know.
That was Bobby, my dear next door neighbor.
Our first house we bought with the intention of flipping it, and we spent 7 years working on it to sell it and then move.